From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. Following America's political news, if you have to, can feel overwhelming. Border crisis, trade war, nuclear talks, president under investigation, confrontations in public places. But how do Americans outside Washington, who have plenty of other things to do, interpret these events 4 months before midterm elections? This hour on Point, a citizens' roundtable with perspectives from Tennessee, Missouri, and Colorado. Also yours. Join us on air or online. How's the country doing, really? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Tennessee is Carl Hill, a longtime On Point listener. You may know him as Carl from Nashville, a frequent caller to our show. He owns a hauling and metal recycling company. Carl, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
With us from Missouri is Yvonne Ratzkowski, a realtor in Joplin, Missouri. Yvonne, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, John.
And joining us from Colorado, Alex Leith, a civil engineer based in Denver. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
And to add his insights, Michael Warren, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. He joins us from Washington. Michael, welcome back.
Hi, John.
Michael, let me just ask you to quickly get us caught up on some of the news from last night. We had primary results. Mitt Romney won an election. There was a notable primary in New York State. What was the upshot?
Pretty much all across the country. There were several states that had primaries for congressional seats, Senate seats. You mentioned Utah, also Colorado, South Carolina, several other states. And the upshot really there is that expected candidates, usually establishment candidates, whether in the Republican primaries or in the Democratic primaries, won. And the big exception to that happened in New York, and specifically in a district in New York City that encompasses parts of the Bronx and Queens, where a longtime Democratic House member, Joe Crowley, lost his bid for the Democratic nomination to a really relatively unknown 28-year-old self-proclaimed Democratic socialist named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. A big upset, a lot of analysis coming out of what this means for the future of the Democratic Party.
Some people thought Crowley might be a future Speaker of the House.
That's right. And this is really seen, I think, among Democrats in the House conference as a vote against the kind of House establishment for the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, Ocasio-Cortez said that she wouldn't vote necessarily for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker. So you can read this in a lot of different ways. She was much more progressive on several issues, including immigration, than Crowley, and really ran against him on those issues. But also, she fits the district a little more. It's a majority-minority district, mostly Hispanic. Joe Crowley was not Hispanic. He was older than the district is. And a lot of analysis, I think, misses this point, which is that Ocasio-Cortez is just a better representative.
Well, let's see how this is refracted by people who are not as close to it as you and I, Michael. And Yvonne, I want to start with you. You have been a supporter of President Trump. His presidency is now just about 18 months in. How do you think he's doing, and how do you think we're doing, the country?
I think he's doing well. I think he is following through on campaign promises and things he said he would do for the country. And I think the country, from where I stand, I think things are going better than expected.
In Joplin, Missouri, you're a real estate agent.
Tell
me about how the economy is broadly and how it is in your business.
Broadly, I think joblessness is down, unemployment's down. I believe in our local area, we are having a lovely spring and summer. We had a really good market all through the fall and winter as well, which is very unusual. We tend to be very streaky and very seasonally challenged when it comes to real estate. We have had a really, really great spring and summer, and we're looking into a good fall as well. We're having a really good shift. It's very much a seller's market. People are buying homes. Their consumer confidence in that respect is up.
And Yvonne, one more thing. In Washington, those of us very close to this political process are walking around with elevated blood pressures all the time because it seems tense. It seems anxious. There's a lot of high decibel conflict, not just between the parties, but between some people in the parties and the press. Are the blood pressures elevated in Joplin, or are people pretty relaxed about how things are going?
I personally feel things are more relaxed. As you know, we tend to be a much more conservative state, which goes against how I was raised. However, my beliefs have shifted. I don't feel that tension. We don't necessarily feel so much dis-ease. Things are going well. People seem to be happy. I don't feel that tension. I don't feel the elevated temperature as maybe you do in Washington.
Carl Hill, people feeling happy in Nashville?
Somewhat. There's a lot of people that's disappointed that they supported Trump. A lot of people don't like to be called out on some of his rhetoric, some of his awful behavior. But you knew at the end of the day what you were getting with this man. So a lot of people are really regretting it, but they won't say it because most people don't want to be proven wrong.
Alex Leith, how about Denver?
Here in Denver, we're pretty much feeling the same way as Carl is in Nashville. I mean, there's a lot of things that Trump has done right that we're okay with supporting, but as far as some of his rhetoric, some of his...
Give an example of something that you think is rubbing people that you interact with the wrong way.
I mean, we can take a look at how he's been treating the immigration debate in recent months, or how he's been bashing the media for the last, heck, I'd even say two and a half years, calling him fake news. I mean, that constantly rubs people the wrong way here in Denver.
Guys, I want to play a bit of sound that relates to a major Supreme Court decision that came out yesterday about the travel ban that the president attempted to implement immediately when he took office and then was thwarted by the courts for a while. During a meeting with congressional leaders at the White House, Trump called the Supreme Court's ruling a great victory for the Constitution and the American people.
This is a great victory for our Constitution. We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
Yvonne, do you agree with the president that this is a great victory?
I don't know that it's nearly as great as he would like everyone to believe. This is his third iteration on the ban. The fact that the Supreme Court did uphold it, although they don't buy into his rhetoric, they don't necessarily agree with the language and the behavior. It is, however, I believe, necessary for national security. I don't think it's fantastic, but I do believe it's constitutional. I would have to agree with the Supreme Court on that.
All right, let's listen to the president on a different issue. On Saturday, during a roundtable discussion on tax reform in Las Vegas, President Trump touted his agenda on trade and putting America first.
I got elected on Make America Great Again. We started using America First, and that's what we're doing on trade. We're renegotiating some of these horrible trade deals that we have with other countries. We have some of the worst deals I've ever seen. Whether it's China, the European Union, Mexico, Canada, you name it, we have a bad deal.
Alex Leith, let me go to you on this. One of the things that some people in different parts of the country are seeing is the president's rattling cages in Canada and Mexico, in Europe, in China. And sometimes the blowback that we're getting, say, on farmers in the Midwest, sanctions against soybean exports from the United States, people are saying, whoa, that's not what I bargained for. Harley Davidson said it was going to shift some production overseas as part of tariffs. How do you think your neighbors, your business colleagues are reacting to all the talk about trade wars?
As far as the trade wars are concerned, same thing everyone I've talked to in my own beliefs on the subject. We don't understand why he's doing this with our allies, with Canada and with members of the European Union. To us, that just doesn't make any sense. With China, I mean, yes, they've been shifting their money and doing illegal monetary practices, and they've been stealing our technology, some of our software rights. I think Blizzard had an issue with their Overwatch game when it first released, and then 6 months later, a Chinese copy came out that was, the exact same gameplay. So China makes some amount of sense, but not with our allies.
Carl, does trade war and tariffs make sense to you?
Well, it doesn't, but let's step back just for a second. We can't gloss over the decision from the Supreme Court yesterday, if you don't mind.
Sure.
We're going to be talking about that decision for the next 25, 50 to 100 years. This is what happened. Elections have consequences. And when you elect someone like Donald Trump, you're going to get people like that on the Supreme Court. They went back and put in North Korea and Venezuela. We know exactly what it was. Donald Trump candidate told us this was a Muslim ban. So what's next? Are we going to have a Christian ban? Are we going to have a Jewish ban? You can't stand, and we can't gloss over something as important as this.
You think this ruling is going to be with us for a long time?
This ruling is going to be with us until we get rid of it, but it will be remembered for a long time, yes.
Carl, Alex, Yvonne, and Michael, stay right there. We're surveying the country with a citizens' roundtable, and you can join this conversation. What do you make of the Supreme Court ruling on the travel ban, the threat of trade wars, the crisis on the border? How does the country look from where you live? Are we in crisis? I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill, and she says she thinks he's got a gun, or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy. Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're checking the mood of our country with a roundtable of voters, and you can join the conversation. Is our economy cruising or driving toward trouble? Are our politics getting too hot? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Alex Leith from Denver, Colorado, Yvonne Rzeszkowski from Joplin, Missouri, and Carl Hill from Nashville, Tennessee. And we're joined by Michael Warren of the Weekly Standard. And Michael, I want to go to you first. Just before the break, I asked the question, is the country in crisis? And as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought, what an odd question to pose at a time when the unemployment rate's under 4%, the economy seems to be going well, and yet there is a sense of angst about the quality of our politics. How do you sense from your reporting on politics that Americans are resolving those two things at the same time?
Well, I think it's first important to point out what Yvonne said, which is that the tension probably out in the rest of the country is much lower than it is here in Washington. It seems if there is a crisis, it's a political one, and that's one that sort of affects the political class more than sort of it does nationally. But of course,
so we need to take a vacation. In other words, you and me.
Yes, let me get right on that. That would be great. But look, I mean, it also depends on where you're coming from. If you are somebody in, say, a Hispanic community who knows people who are crossing the border and are dealing with the administration's zero tolerance policy or erstwhile zero tolerance policy, it might seem like a crisis for you at this very moment. So, of course, it's a big country. It's a lot of different viewpoints, a lot of different opinions on things. But the sense of there's been a lot of talk in Washington about civility. This is something that I think is a crisis for the political class. And this is where Donald Trump really has been the most disruptive to our politics. It's that he has sort of changed the game on what is acceptable in terms of political discourse, what sort of groups are acceptable. You've seen sort of the rise of alt-right groups, white nationalist groups, and then on the left, it's been quiet recently. But, of course, at the beginning of the administration, there was this focus on anti-fascist groups that were getting violent as well. So this is something that's on the fringes, but it's, I think, affecting our politics in a way that maybe doesn't quite affect, sort of normal everyday Americans in their everyday interactions with each other and with their with their communities.
Well, let's bring Ohio into the conversation and see exactly whether those tensions are affecting Dayton, where Kathleen is calling from. Kathleen, welcome to On Point.
Hello, John. I go back and forth from Dayton, Ohio, where I take care of my 90-year-old mother who grew up working in factories here in Dayton. And I go to Boulder, Colorado, where I take her with me, where I take care of two grandsons. So I walk the neighborhoods. I'm fascinated with what's going on with people's lives. I always have been. So here in Dayton, I've been walking North Dayton and East Dayton, talking to some of the same people I've been talking with over the last 5 years. And they're in old manufacturing neighborhoods, a lot of poor working class people. And I just walked that neighborhood the other day talking to some of the same people, and their lives have not changed. A lot of them shop at the Family Dollar there on Troy Street in Dayton. And, you know, there are manufacturing buildings in shambles in these neighborhoods. And I hear about the increase of minimum wage jobs, but I don't see any good paying jobs for these people to be able to access. In Boulder, I walk multi-million dollar neighborhoods where there are Hispanic neighborhoods mixed in with trailer courts. I talk to a lot of Hispanic people, and you know, they're working in these multi-million dollar yards and houses for way below the prevailing wage, and nothing has changed under the Trump administration, and I don't know if much changed for these people under the Obama administration, quite frankly. I just don't see or talk with people who can't access capital to buy real estate, like one of your guests was mentioning. I don't see anything changing in their lives.
Well, that's a terrific point, Kathleen. And in reality, the lives of a lot of those working class people have not changed for decades. And I want to ask Yvonne, President Trump said, he talked about American carnage, and he said, I'm going to remember the forgotten people. Kathleen is pointing out that a lot of those forgotten people don't feel any benefit. What do you see in Joplin?
I see that there are first-time home buyers that never would have been able to purchase homes before because they do have better jobs. I see home buyers who are confident enough to buy second homes. I don't see what she's seeing. I don't have the experience of Dayton, Ohio. We have a large Hispanic community here, and they do more than just lawns, to be quite honest. So I'm not seeing the same thing she is seeing.
Carl Hill, do you see a step up in the lives of working class people in Nashville, Tennessee?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, Trump lawyers will refuse to see anything that's standing right in front of their face. I mean, think about it for a minute. Republicans, they don't get off the hook. A lot of people like to blame Trump for what's going on right now. But this thing started with Newt Gingrich and those guys, Frank Luntz, the little wordsmith. All these problems that we have. And Donald Trump is just the result of something that's been going on in this country for 25, 30 years. And what he has done and what the Republican Party, who we tend to let off the hook as being hostages of Donald Trump, we can't allow that. They constantly have bills and laws that pass that go unnoticed by the American public that actually hurt poor people, middle class people. Look at the tax bill. The tax bill was basically a giveaway to millionaires and billionaires. Oh, sure, they're going to give you a $500 bonus, but are they going to give you a raise? Are they going to raise your wages from $7 to $14? No, they're going to reinvest in stocks in their country and have a whirlwind of cash coming into them. And after your $500 is gone, then what? So, no, this has been a major bait and switch done by the Republican Party. Can't let them off the hook just by blaming Donald Trump.
Alex Leith, Kathleen was talking about spending part of the year in Boulder, Colorado, as well as Dayton, Ohio. Do you see what she saw, which is in Denver, which is a failure to improve in any meaningful way the lives of working class Coloradans?
Yeah, that's what we're seeing here in Boulder. It's what I've been seeing a lot of in Denver, up down in Colorado Springs, up in Fort Collins. I drive all over the state for my job and for past jobs. And I mean, respectfully, with that, like my own personal experiences with this have been quite similar. I just got my first job out of college, which is, you know, paying about $17 an hour, which is a lot more than I've been used to making. But even then, with a college education, working in a, you know, leading civil engineering firm, I still can't afford, you know, a decent apartment, and I still can't, you know, moving into a home or anything else like that is completely out of the question.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bob on the line. Yvonne, this is one of your neighbors from Joplin, Missouri. Bob, go right ahead.
Hello, John. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to counter what the lady from Joplin had to say. I know a lot of people here who are just upset having Trump as president for a lot of reasons, just his demeanor and undignified manner of speaking to the public.
Bob, is that the most important thing, is how he talks as opposed to what his policies are?
Well, no, his policies are the most important, and his foreign policies are a disaster as far as I'm concerned. He has autocratic tendencies. He's making friends with our enemies, and he's making enemies of our friends. I think what he did in Canada, the way he treated the G7 was just reprehensible. So,
but Bob, let me take it back just for a second to Joplin. Yvonne was saying she's seeing people getting better jobs, being able to afford homes, a first home, or people having a step up in their quality of life. Do you see that too?
No, not really. Of course, she has a better sense of that because she's a realtor. No, I don't see the neighborhood that I'm living in, has, you know, their houses are, somewhat dilapidated. People can't, afford to, really take care of their property. Joplin, of course, has had an influx of money because of the tornado in 2011. So there seems to be a lot of building going on, but I think it's an exception. I think the communities around Joplin are not feeling any kind of financial boom from this administration.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Yvonne, your reaction?
I understand that we all come from different places and we all walk different paths. I just see it differently. I understand that President Trump is brash, and I certainly don't always agree with his demeanor, but that isn't the most important. You know, minimum wage has been raised several times. The minimum wage is significantly higher than when I had my first minimum wage job. But those are also entry-level positions. So I don't understand. I understand they feel as though we're making enemies, but we're also having to cross some bridges and make some allies where there weren't allies before. So he's making strides that no other president has been able to make.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's get a voice from North Carolina. We've got Mike on the line from Elkin. Mike, welcome to On Point, and go right ahead.
Okay. I would just like to know, you know, you guys are discussing this, and you're thinking that things will change in 18 months. I mean, it's took, what, 30 years for it to get this way? And everybody there seems to think in 18 months everything should change. Everybody should be all happy, happy. But that's not going to happen.
Mike, I think that's a good bit of perspective. And I want to get Carl Hill's reaction to that. Carl, do you think people are too impatient and not giving Trump chance to see the results of his policies?
And thank you for teeing that up for me. I'm going to tell you this right here. We said the same thing about President Obama. Think about where we were. The stock market was at 6,000. Everything was crashing around us. Everything. And they gave him nothing but hell. They never gave this man a chance. And now this guy want us to give Donald Trump a chance? He want us to get the same guy that probably was protesting against President Obama when he was turning around the economy, saving the American motor industry, stopping a Great Depression, and now he want us to give this guy a chance. No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that because the things that he's doing are proven, even in policy, not to help the little guy. And I have to push back on the guests from Missouri saying that we got to build bridges. So we're building bridges with dictators. The regime in North Korea, I don't know if you noticed or not, but they lock people up. And when they lock people up, they lock them generationally up. They lock them up for life, their family. And their family is encouraged to turn in other family members while they're locked up with those family members. So for us to just gloss over that and say, you know, let's make friends with murderers like Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un, let's be friends with those guys and let's ostracize our friends to the north, our neighbors in Canada, our partners in the EU, let's just make enemies of them. That's unacceptable. That should not go by without having any comments on something like that.
Michael Warren, I want to ask you about the point that the caller and Carl both raised, and that is the time horizon we have for judging politicians. You know, somebody comes into office and a verdict is pronounced very rapidly on what they're doing. Can good government work that way? Do we need time to see if different approaches work?
I think it's a difficult task, particularly when you're talking about economic activity, economic health, to sort of ascribe it to immediately ascribe it to an administration to say, well, the economy's bad and that's because of this current president, or the economy's bad and that's because of the previous president, because the economy is something that's actually very complex and hard to pinpoint certainly policies from a White House to say immediately these are having a good effect. But politically—
The economy is slow, but politically all we have is quick twitch muscles.
That's right. And so I do think that President Trump benefits from an economy that is obviously doing very well. You can look at the markets and see that. That may or may not have to do with his own policies. You talk to some people who say that the tax cuts, are actually the anticipation of the tax cuts, had a lot to do with sort of economic confidence among the business community. But I am struck, John, by a recent poll actually from your network, CNBC, that found the president's economic approval rating up, and now 51% approve of his of his handling of the economy. In that same poll, they found that the president's overall approval rating was 10 points lower, 41%. It's a surge for him, but I think that difference is exactly some of the guests have been bringing up, which is people may embrace his policies and 51% embracing his approach to the economy, but that lag, that difference there, I think, is reflective of the feeling that the political culture has been coarsened in part because of the president, maybe some frustrations or concern about his approach to foreign policy and national security. And in those realms, I think the president can be much more closely and much more accurately tied to the way things currently are.
Alex Leith, do you think the president, from your perspective, deserves more time, or do you think you've seen enough to form a judgment?
I definitely think he needs just a little more time, but even going on the last 18 months of his presidency, I think we can fairly and safely judge how he's been doing.
Does that mean that you personally have ruled out supporting his reelection?
For me personally, yes. But depending on whatever policy decisions he makes in the next 18 or 24 months, I may change my mind.
Michael, Carl, Yvonne, Alex, hold right there. We're taking a citizens' roundtable on where America stands in the summer of 2018. And we'd like you to join us. We want to hear what's happening in your state. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, and we're talking with a panel of voters from across the country. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Yvonne Rzeszkowski from Joplin, Missouri, Carl Hill from Nashville, Tennessee, and Alex Leith from Denver, Colorado, and we're joined by Michael Warren of the Weekly Standard. Guys, I want to play a piece of sound that concerns an issue that's gotten a lot of coverage lately and may have helped lift the president's approval rating for a while, and that is his nuclear talks with North Korea. On Saturday, President Trump called his meeting with Kim Jong-un very successful and said the process toward total denuclearization is beginning, with more talks between the two countries to come.
Most importantly, I have a very good relationship. We have a good chemistry together. We got along very well. He's a smart, tough guy. He's a great negotiator. I think he sees a tremendous future for North Korea, but we want to have it denuclearized, and that's what's happening.
Yvonne, I want to go to you first on this. I think, and I'll be presumptive and speak for Michael on this, that the kinds of people he and I talk to in Washington who specialize in issues of foreign policy and nuclear diplomacy would say that nothing much has actually been agreed to. They had a meeting. But the president's making the argument that Americans should feel safer as a result. Do you feel safer? Do you think Joplin is safer as a result of this meeting?
There was a meeting. That in and of itself is a standout against all other administrations. So the fact that they were at least willing to come to the table speaks volumes.
But now, just to clarify a little bit, you realize, Yvonne, that North Korea was always willing to come to the table. It was the United States that was not willing to grant them a meeting on the theory that that would elevate their status until they were ready to make some concessions, and they have not made those concessions.
Well, I understand, and I'm not glossing over anything. What I'm saying is I think that a meeting had to happen. You can't come to terms with anything, and I understand that there were demands and commands that were not met. However, I think to open a discussion on denuclearization, there initially has to be a discussion, and to discuss that, there has to be a meeting. I understand there other administrations were not willing, and why. However, somebody's going to have to speak first.
Carl Hill,
somebody's going to have to be willing to speak.
Carl, do you see the meeting itself as a sign of progress? Does that ease your concerns about nuclear conflict?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You cannot give this mass murderer. He killed his own brother, for God's sakes. And you have Donald Trump talking about how great of a guy he is, how he's a good guy, how they clicked, how they related. Think about this for me. Can you imagine if President Obama had said the same thing about Raul Castro? The right would be exploding right now. You must have these type of meetings behind closed doors at a lower level, and everything must be ironed out before you set this dictator in front of the president of the United States and sign some type of agreement. They got absolutely nothing. What they got was propaganda. What we got was a photo op for Donald Trump. This is what we got. And until his supporters understand this, we won't go anywhere in this country. This guy is all about the photo op. anything else be damned.
Alex,
you cannot.
Alex Leith, do you think that the president made progress?
I mean, he's made the same progress that Bill Clinton made back when he was sending people from his administration to talk to North Korea. And then, forgive me, I think there was another administration back in the late 70s, earlier 80s, who would also send people to talk with North Korea. To me, at least, that's where that's the exact same steps that President Trump has taken. And for this, I would like to. Yeah, I agree with Carl on this in the sense that, you know, the right would have exploded if Obama had, you know, talked with Castro, and the right did explode when when Obama had made the Iran deal, or the Iran denuclearization deal, and the Iran talks. They were saying, "Oh, you're meeting with this, you know, all these mass murderers, and you're meeting with, you know, this, you know, very overzealous regime," and we're seeing a complete reversal in. A Hippocratic reversal with the right in terms of North Korea.
Michael, did I state accurately that foreign policy experts don't see much in the way of concrete results from this meeting?
Yes. The folks I talk to who follow this very much say wait and see. They're skeptical, but they really do want to wait and see, because it is true, as Yvonne said, no other president has done this. But I think the concerns about the conditions and the fact that the president seems to be sending mixed signals, saying at many times that the nuclear threat from North Korea is over. Nobody else in his administration is willing to say that, because it's not true. And there has been no progress, meaningful progress, in terms of actually ensuring that that is the case. There have been some indications that North Korea has turned off or destroyed some of its testing sites, but that does not really rise to the level of what experts call CVID, which is which basically says that it's complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. But I am struck by something that that Alex pointed out, which is a lot of the arguments against what the president is doing with regard to North Korea, that liberals and opponents of Trump are making, were very much the same as what conservatives were making about the Iran nuclear deal under President Obama, and vice versa. A lot of the justifications that Trump supporters make for the president going to Singapore and speaking with Kim were the justifications that that the Obama administration was making for the Iran nuclear deal, essentially saying, "What else are you going to do?" It's just very interesting to see. Really, I think how people really look at these things in terms of what is my side doing, and in general gravitating toward support, even if it is hypocritical. If you sort of extrapolate it out to another issue from the other side of the political aisle,
right? Now let's bring Carl. I want to go to one more caller, and I'll come to you right after this caller. Let's bring Virginia into the conversation. We've got Keith on the line from Gate City. Keith, welcome to On Point, and go right ahead.
Hi, John. What I'm wanting to say is, I no longer look at what he is saying. I'm looking at what America is not doing. We've lost our moral compass in this nation. When you can make fun of people and call people names, profane names and stuff, and babies are our enemies, and Trudeau's our enemies, but Putin and North Korea and Saudi Arabia and all of these authoritarian regimes are our friends, there is something wrong in our thinking. And God help us if we're going down this road that Germany and Italy and Soviet Russia and all of those places went down, believing that there are quick, easy solutions to complex problems. And, I mean, I don't understand it. I didn't watch it on TV in the campaign, but when I read he made fun of a handicapped reporter, and I heard no one say anything about that. John McCain is the only person in the Republican Party who has the guts to call this man for what he is, someone with no character, no integrity. And as I read in a conservative journalist last week who said, that they no longer recognize this country. And at the age of 76, the country I grew up in, I no longer recognize it. I never did think that I would live to see the day that people marching against people saying the Jews will not overtake us are equated as being good with the people who were marching against them. I'm saddened by our country, and we're on a path, and we're on it down. We're going very, very quickly.
Keith, thanks so much for your call. And Carl Hill, let me start with you. Does Donald Trump have a moral compass, and has our country lost our moral compass?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. To step back just for a second about the Iran deal and talking to North Korea, the difference is this. The people on the right that lost their mind, there was a deal made, an actual signing, an actual deal made with Iran. People from the left were supporting that because it was like you said, what are we going to do? Go to war. I don't find it hypocritical that now people on the left are against this. There's no deal being made. What we are against is photo ops and holding up a dictator like Kim and holding him up next to the presidency, bringing him up to that level. As far as Donald Trump goes, I don't ever want to hear, and I mean this, I don't want to hear the Republican Party come to me ever again with their Christian values, with their family values. This is a man who cheated on his first wife with his other wife, cheated on his other wife with his other wife, and now being alleged to cheating on his wife with the porn star. There's nothing that these people could ever say to me ever again about values when you are electing and following the policies of this degenerate, Donald Trump.
Yvonne, what do you think about the issue of personal morality in President Trump?
I believe fully Donald Trump was never a politician. And I believe that the country voted against politicians. Now, Bill Clinton wasn't the family man everybody thought he was either. You don't see that being brought up. He was also impeached. He was also accused. Donald Trump is brash. He never claimed to be polished. And you have to take the good with the bad. He has never been a wallflower. He has never been a reclusive person. He is always in your face, trying to stir people up.
Yvonne, just to clarify, is your point that Donald Trump is not bad on a personal basis in terms of morality, or that he's just like everyone else?
I think he's more like everybody else, quite frankly. Unfortunately, there are plenty of cheaters and liars and people who are behaving in a way behind closed doors that they wouldn't want people in front of them to see. Now, am I saying that he's the greatest husband on the planet? No, I am not. I'm also not married to him.
Well, speaking about Trump and truthfulness, I want to go to one other issue, which is the Russia investigation. While walking to his helicopter on the South Lawn of the White House earlier this month, President Trump strongly criticized the Mueller investigation and emphasized his presidential powers.
I do have an absolute right to pardon myself, but I'll never have to do it because I didn't do anything wrong. And everybody knows it. There's been no collusion. There's been no obstruction. It's all a made-up fantasy. It's a witch hunt. No collusion, no obstruction, no nothing. Now, the Democrats have had massive collusion, massive obstruction, and they should be investigated.
Alex Leith, do you believe him?
Not in the slightest. I mean, you take a look at the Russian investigation over the last, year and a half now. We've had 30-some-odd convictions come out of it. Proof that there's, you know, corruption, proof that there was illegality occurring within the Trump campaign. And I mean, we've seen plenty of smoke and we've, you know, caught whiffs of the fire. And it's disheartening that Trump would continue to go on and rant about it like that. And it's even more disconcerting that he's saying that he can pardon himself, which constitutionally he cannot, not in the slightest.
All right, let's bring Georgia into the conversation. We've got Kelly on the line from Columbus. Kelly, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I served 9 years in the U.S. Army, and then I went to school for pre-law. Now I'm a stay-at-home mom. But I think that people are being a bit impatient with President Trump. I think that change is definitely incremental. You have to allow time for change to happen at the top and then go to the bottom. I also think that these problems of, you know, where people live and affording houses, they're complex problems. We also have other avenues to solve these problems. We have state government. We have local government. And I think that it's seriously an issue when we want to look at the president and blame him as our sole problem for not being able to afford a home or, you know, for these other issues when we have
avenues
where we can make change.
Kelly, what are you seeing in Columbus? Do you feel like day-to-day life is improving, or are you just saying that it's not, but we need to be patient?
I've only been here 6 months. We moved from Texas, but from what I see, I don't see it improving. Poverty is really bad, but I also know that a lot of people aren't, how do I say this? You know, decisions have consequences. And I think as a mom and as an American, we need to start teaching our children that all your decisions have consequences, and big government isn't supposed to make small decisions for us. Big government was supposed to provide equal opportunity, and we're supposed to have the opportunity and make decisions. And, you know, that drives the path of our lives. But, you know, I think what we're expecting big government to achieve is nearly impossible. And then we want to throw blame and say, well, we're not going to support the president. We're creating more divide when we want to say we're not going to support the president, you know. And as far as being a Christian and a Republican and saying, you know, to your other gentleman on your show, you know, he's not going to take our advice or whatever. I know the Bible says to respect your government. Do I respect every decision that President Trump is making? No, but the Bible does tell me to respect my government. And I'm going to do that as a veteran, as a mom, and as a Christian.
Kelly, I really appreciate your calling. That was a valuable perspective. I think we're just about out of time. Carl Hill from Nashville, so glad that you called into the show.
Thank you very much.
Alex Leith of Denver, Colorado, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Yvonne Reskowski from Joplin, Missouri, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Michael Warren from the Weekly Standard, thanks for making us smarter as we continued that conversation.
Thanks a lot, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Alice Poli, Jeremy Reyosa, James Ross, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Caroline Anders. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up tomorrow, from gerrymandering to the cake baker and the travel ban, we'll wrap up a big term at the Supreme Court with top reporters who covered it all. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.